Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 58 for July 13th, 2010. I'm Ben Snitkoff and I'll be one of your hosts today. With me today I've got
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First of all, we're going to talk about Judge Nancy Gertner reducing the damages in the Joel Tenenbaum versus the RIAA lawsuit. Second, we're going to talk about a patent that Amazon was recently awarded on the Kindle e-reader and what effect that may have on other readers. And lastly, we're going to talk about a lawsuit which brings the Creative Commons license to the forefront, and you know what implications that will have for the Creative Commons and the other licenses. So first off, we're going to talk about the Joel Tenenbaum case, and we're going to throw that to David O'Brien. So David, take it away.
So just on Friday, we got word about this. Out of the district court here in Massachusetts, Judge Nancy Gertner, who also tried the case, has finally issued her order regarding Joel Tenenbaum, who's the defendant in the case, regarding a motion that they had filed on the issue of damages. Now, if you recall, just last year, approximately about a year ago, almost to the week, Joel Tenenbaum was found liable for infringing approximately 30 songs using peer-to-peer software. And this, of course, was the second case to make it to trial in the United States, the first of which you're probably familiar with was the Jamie Thomas Rassett case. Now, in this case, the damages for the 30 songs was $675,000, and that was found by the jury. And just for 30 songs, so that was approximately $22,500 per song. Quite the expensive album, if you ask me. And now we're seeing that Nancy Gertner agreed with some of the arguments that were presented by Tenenbaum's counsel and has also agreed to reduce the damages to approximately one-tenth of that $675,000 or $67,500. A lot of interesting things going on in here. This is a pretty landmark ruling on this issue. So what do you guys think about this initially, and are there any other facts that you guys might want to talk about?
The first thing that I want to point out is that the amount to which Judge Gertner, reduced the award was the same as it was in the Jamie Thomas Rassett case. Both Judge Gertner and I'm blanking on the judge's name in the Jamie Thomas case reduced
Michael
it
Davis.
To Michael Davis reduced the damages to three times the minimum statutory amount per song infringed. The big difference, though, and we'll get to this later, is that Judge Gertner's opinion said that that was the maximum that the Constitution would allow, and Judge Davis's opinion just said that was the maximum that any reasonable jury could find.
So there's a big difference there between those the reasoning and those two separate opinions, and as you noted, Ben, or maybe you didn't point this out, the basis of Judge Gertner's ruling was basically on constitutional grounds. And she found that the damages that had been awarded by the jury in this case were simply not constitutional. And that became sort of her support for reducing the ultimate award.
Right. We've discussed the principles behind this before, and every time we discussed it, we kind of thought that this was a shot-in-the-dark argument that wouldn't really hold water. But Judge Gertner did a very good job in the opinion, and it's a lengthy opinion, it's about 64 pages, of laying out the analogous cases on the sides of punitive damages. So, as you know, sometimes in tort cases, not only will the victim of whatever, you know, thing exploded, or, you know, the oil leak, or the, you know, somebody who got cancer from tobacco, not only would they get money compensating them for their medical bills and pain and suffering, but they would also get money punitive damages to discourage the defendants from doing this kind of thing again. And the Supreme Court has held in a rather long and confusing line of cases that punitive damages are checked by due process, that generally they can't be more than 10 times what the compensatory damages are. And you know, there are a whole slew of tests that go on that the Supreme Court looks at in order to weigh what exactly are appropriate punitive damages. And what Judge Gertner did is, you know, went through step by step and said, you know, no, we're not really worried about the defendant here not being on notice that he could have to pay those damages, which is one of those considerations. But what we are worried about is that the punishment is grossly excessive, and grossly out of line with what the actual damages were.
So one of the big problems here, at least as I see it, is that there hasn't been a ruling like this using that particular reasoning in a copyright case. And some would argue that there's a big distinction between a statutory damages scheme like you have here in the Copyright Act, which basically provides a range for the jury after a defendant has been held liable for the infringement itself. The jury is then left to determine what the correct award would be, for instance, of infringement, and the statute says that this has to be an amount, if the infringement is willful, between $750 and $150,000 per work. It's a huge range, a wide spectrum of damages to choose from, and there isn't much guidance on how to choose the correct amount, so a lot is sort of left to the jury to decide. But as I pointed out, this has never been the subject of another opinion, and a lot of people point to the fact that this is in the statute itself. It's actually embodied in the codified law. Whereas if you're talking about punitive damages in another type of torts case, punitive damages are sort of a more abstract concept, although they're widely accepted under common law, and sometimes even you have language and statutes that say that a plaintiff can actually get actual or compensatory damages plus any punitive damages which might apply. They usually don't prescribe actual amounts, or if they do, they'll give it a figurative number like 2x or 3x. We call it 3x treble damages, meaning that you're multiplying the amount of actual damages by a multiplier, and then you're coming to the actual amount. So, do you guys agree with the substantive analysis in the opinion? I mean, did Judge Gertner here reach the right decision? Is this one that is likely to stay the decision?
What I find interesting in this case is even with the reduction so significantly, they're still saying it's too much.
Yeah, I believe so. Prior to the litigation itself, Joel Tenenbaum, like a lot of people have received, Joel Tenenbaum received a letter saying you should settle before we take this case to trial or before we decide to litigate this case from the RIAA. And in that letter, it said you can settle for $4,000. And I don't know if it was on the advice of his counsel or if this was on his own initiative. Obviously, Joel did not choose to settle. So the $4,000 is a much smaller amount than the $675,000. But since then, and since the award, which came out last year, Joel Tenenbaum has said that he would have been unwilling financially, or unable financially, to pay either the $4,000 that they wanted, a couple of years ago when the infringement actually occurred or when he received the letter, and definitely would be unable to pay the $675,000 award, and of course the $67,000 award.
If I remember the sequence correctly, initially the RIAA's offer to settle was $2,000, and Joel couldn't do that and kind of dragged his feet for a while. Finally got the $2,000, and by the time he did that, the RIAA had increased the amount to $4,000, which then he couldn't cover. Going back to the point as to whether or not this is the right decision, I think it's extraordinarily well reasoned. I think it breaks new ground in statutory damages and the analysis of punitive damages to that. And in fact, Judge Gertner at one point kind of flips this on its head and says, this line of cases has previously been held to protect big business against, juries. And, this is my putting a stick in the ground and saying, well, the due process clause in this case will also protect little people against big companies. That being said, Judge Gertner is kind of like the Ninth Circuit when it comes to her opinions. They get flipped a lot. She's known for going out on a limb, making new law, stretching the law, and getting reversed by the First Circuit Court of Appeals. And I don't think there's any question that the RIAA is going to appeal to the First Circuit to try to get this decision reversed.
So before we discuss anything else, because there's some other interesting things about this case, just on a procedural question that I have, since this was decided on constitutional grounds, I'm not sure if this was actually treated as a remitter, and so then the RIAA would have the option of either going ahead and requesting a new trial on the issue of damages, like has happened in the Thomas Rassett case, or if they have to accept this on its face. Do you know, Ben?
They do have to, well, their choices are accepted or appeal. There's no option for a new trial because the holding isn't that in the judge's view this jury acted unreasonably. It's the Constitution says that even if you were to get a new trial, you wouldn't be able to get more than this amount of money. Having a new trial won't do them any good because right now in Judge Gertner's courtroom and in the District of Massachusetts, they're not going to get a dime more than what Judge Gertner says, because even if they do, she'll just point back to this decision and say, you see my analysis here that says that you're not going to get any more than that because it's unconstitutional? It's still the case. So if they want more money, they're going to have to go to the First Circuit Court of Appeals to try to get them to flip her decision.
So we should probably just talk a tiny bit about what the factors were that the judge considered when she decided that this was a grossly excessive award of damages. Do you guys have any thoughts on what those were? Or just want to list what the factors were that she took into consideration?
My favorite factor was that Senator Hatch admitted to downloading files on peer-to-peer networks, and that there was some indication that that Congress did not intend for, you know, this breadth of statutory damages to apply to individuals downloading for non-commercial purposes. But I interrupted you, Dominic, so you go.
I was just going to say that one factor that I'm sure the judge took into consideration was the cost of the songs themselves. They're usually about $1, $1.29 on iTunes, and we're talking about 30 songs or so. Apparently also the settlement letter was the original offer that the record companies made to Tenenbaum was $3,500, so $3.5K, and he offered $500.
Interesting.
Which might give you an idea of what number they're kind of hoping to end up at.
So let's talk a little bit, though, about the calculation differences in terms of a damages award and the actual or compensatory damages here. So she spent some time at length, and we should probably stress that it's really worth reading the opinion because it's very interesting. But she spent some time at length describing how the damages were somewhere around the actual cost of the song, which if you were to purchase it on a program or in a store like iTunes, you're talking about songs which are sold at retail for 99 cents or $1.29. And then she broke it down a little further and said, well, the record companies are pretty much getting 70 cents out of that, at least in the case of the 99-cent songs. So because we're talking about 30 songs, really we're talking about $30 worth of damages. Do you guys agree with that?
There are certain, you know, less calculable parts of this damage. And in fact, I think Judge Gertner's opinion contradicts that at some point. Looking at the version that I have, bottom of page 33 to the top of page 34, she writes, he, Tenenbaum, also distributed the songs by putting them in his shared folder. So my guess is this was just something that she put in there without giving it much thought, but the fact that that constitutes distribution is a point of contention, and if it does constitute distribution, that would lead one to believe that the damages were actually greater than just downloading the song, that there was also some measure of damages from keeping these songs in the shared folder and enabling other people to download them, or actually having people download them from his copies.
Right, and I think this is the portion of the opinion which I have the hardest time with, and as you correctly pointed out, you know, it's really difficult to calculate damages in these cases, because when you think about the RIAA and how they go about investigating these things, they're usually going on to these peer-to-peer networks and you know, attempting to either seed files so that other folks can download them, and they're tracking by IP address who is downloading complete files. or they're trying to download them for other people who have shared them through a shared folder or just offered them for download on one of the networks. But they can't really get a grip on who else is, in the latter instance that is, who else is downloading them once they're offered in a shared folder. And because of that, it's really difficult to calculate what the actual damage is just from offering it. And this is a point of contention that's come up in a number of lawsuits. A lot of judges now have come out deciding that it's not copyright infringement if you are just offering to distribute a song without any actual evidence that there was a download that happened or that the distribution process had actually completed itself. And, you know, it's difficult when you consider calculating damages on those issues. And to perhaps to Judge Gertner's credit, I don't believe that there was any evidence at this point that was submitted by the RIAA to show what the actual damages might have been in those instances. So maybe they do have some evidence. But once you have a file that's gotten out there, you can think about how the file might propagate itself exponentially. That is, you know, one person downloads it, then that person keeps it in his shared folder, offers it to download, and five more people download that copy. And so now you've got an exponential number of downloads that are possible, assuming all of those people keep the song in their shared folders. But from the legal perspective, I don't know that that's something that you can easily consider for damages issues like this, because it's abstract.
Yeah, on the flip side, I'm just realizing now that BitTorrent has almost the exact opposite argument. You could make the argument that, yes, you downloaded off of BitTorrent, but even if you weren't sharing it back, that would have no, you know, if you, even if you were sharing it back, that had, regardless of whether or not you were sharing it back, it wouldn't have had any difference on the uploaders, because people aren't searching for it on your computer, they're getting it from a tracker, and because it's a swarm, you know, if you're not in the swarm, it doesn't have any effect, any deletery effect.
Right. So, you know, I think this is where her opinion gets a little bit weak in determining that, you know, the 99 cents metric is the correct one, or the $1.29 metric is the correct one to assess what the actual damages might have been. But nonetheless, I think her actual conclusion differs substantially from that, and she rests on this idea that treble damages, basically, is what this comes down to. Three times the minimum statutory amount is appropriate because it still has the effect of deterring folks from participating in these peer-to-peer networks, and it still is compensating, to some extent, the RIAA or any of the record labels from the actual instances of infringement. And I kind of like that analysis because when you look at a lot of different types of tort cases that are out there that don't have statutory damages provisions, they do include that little language I talked about before, which says that punitive damages are okay to recover in these cases up to treble damages or 3x. And that's a standard that's used a lot. But what makes me nervous about that is that, you know, we're talking generally about statutes that have expressed language that state treble damages is the way that you calculate damages. And we just don't have that here. So really, it's a little bit like a judge that has gone a little bit outside of the norm, or maybe you could even say a lot outside of the norm, and she is almost legislating from the bench a little bit here, because we're talking about the spectrum that Congress came up with, and you have to sort of assume that that's what they intended on the face. And even though, as you pointed out, Ben, before, that there were some interesting legislative history arguments that went on in some of the motions that were filed, those aren't controlling points of law. We just call those, from the legal perspective, persuasive points. So just because that there was some discussion that went on that, you know, oh, we don't really intend this to, you know, go after individuals, and that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that's how this case should be decided. So, you know, I found those points to be a little bit unpersuasive, to be honest. What did you guys think, or do you have any other thoughts on the damage calculations?
I mean, one of the things that Judge Gertner concentrated on was comparing the statutory damage award in this case compared to other similar and even dissimilar cases, and found that in this case, the award was grossly out of proportion with pretty much any other reported decision that involved statutory damages, you know, things where there was commercial use for commercial use of these songs or commercial use of other copyrighted work, and you know, the jury came back with substantially lower awards, and all this you kind of lumped together and said this all points to the fact that, you know, this is grossly excessive, and that, you know, it's just not a reasonable amount of money for somebody to be liable for non-commercial copying of a song.
Yeah, there was some interesting dicta in the opinion as well that stated that Tenenbaum was not likely to go out if he hadn't had access to the peer-to-peer networks. He was not likely to go out and actually purchase the songs from a store or from iTunes, because the value proposition just wasn't there for him. The value that he was getting was just this quick and free access, and so really there might have been even less money lost in this whole transaction. And I think she also pointed to some studies which say that a lot of people that download on peer-to-peer networks most likely are not willing to go out and pay for the song, and so it's not really lost revenue to the labels. It's just sort of like this, you know, almost superfluous type of infringement that goes on.
Increased marketing.
I guess before we wrap this, there are some other quick points we could note. And if you guys recall our discussion about this case last year, there were some really interesting things that happened at trial. First of all, the trial was about 3 days long when it was actually slated to be quite a bit longer. And in particular, that happened because, at least in the depositions, that is, like these, you have these. Basically, questions are asked by both sets of counsel prior to trial. Tenenbaum had said repeatedly that he was not the person who actually initiated the downloads, and he tried to pin the blame on his family members and some friends that might have had access to the computer. But then at trial, when he was on the stand, he actually reversed his course and completely admitted that, yes, I was the person who downloaded these songs. And that was one of the key factual issues in the case, that any factual issue, or most factual issues, that is, are left for the jury to decide. So once he elicited that testimony on the stand, the RIAA filed for a directed verdict, and it was immediately granted the following day. And people don't look too kindly on witnesses, especially defendants, who lie in cases and try to shift the blame when it's, you know, when they are actually at fault. So, you know, there were some somewhat egregious things that Tenenbaum had actually done in the case. Judge Gertner actually discusses a lot of this at length, and it does factor into her ultimate opinion of offering or changing the verdict down to the $67,000. But, you know, we're not looking at a person who, under the law as we know it, with the case law that has been out there, firmly establishes that when you actually participate in infringing activity, you're going to be held liable to the extent of the damages as provided in the Copyright Act. Do you guys have any additional thoughts before we move on to the next story?
I'm all set here.
Okay, Dominic, why don't you take us away?
All right, our next story concerns a patent that just issued on July 6th. Specifically, Amazon has a patent on dual-screen ebook readers. Unlike the Kindle is a single-screen ebook reader. It just has an e-ink display and nothing else. But Amazon has a patent on dual-screen ebook readers that have a e-ink screen, like the Kindle, and then have an additional screen corresponding to that screen in some way, like Barnes & Noble's Nook. This patent was just issued, so now it's up to Amazon to decide what they want to do with it, whether they want to try suing Barnes & Noble over the Nook, assuming the patent applies, which is a question we'll consider, and or whether they want to try licensing it, or what they want to do with it.
But first thing, I want to chime in and say that I think the first Kindle does fall into the breadth of this patent, where because the first Kindle, if you remember, had a little liquid crystal display that ran along the side of the main display.
It did?
And a little roller. So this was, the first Kindle's e-ink display was significantly worse than the second generation Kindles. So what it did for selecting is you had this little LCD
display. Oh, on the
bottom? No. It ran parallel to the display. It was like 2 pixels wide. They were large pixels, but it ran up and down the display. So what you would do is you'd roll the little roller up and down and select a line based on what that roller
Oh,
was
and a line
indicating.
would color in.
You'd click on it
Oh,
and
I see it. I finally found it on a screenshot. No, I see what you're talking about. Okay. It's separate from the display. It's not right next to the display. There's a little gap. Okay. Yes. Then the original Kindle did fall under the patent.
Right, and I mean, reading the claim, and we'll have a link to the patent in the show notes. It says a handheld electronic device with an electronic paper display and a second display positioned alongside the first display, which I think is pretty narrow in describing at least what from what's currently on the market. Just well, nothing that's currently on the market, just the old Kindle. Because if I were describing the Nook, I would say that it was below, and it's the same with the Alex. The secondary display is below the primary e-ink display. Now, whether or not that would, stand up in court and not be subject to the doctrine of equivalence is another question. Do you guys agree with that reading that, the
I
based
would say that,
on
I mean, along which way?
when I think alongside, I think next to, not along the bottom, but I mean, it's
Right,
not what
but
I
to be
think, it's what.
technical, alongside only means side by side or together with. So you could see it alongside, looking at it the other way, just by rotating the Nook, just to be a patent attorney for a second.
Yeah, and I mentioned the doctrine of equivalence, which says that
Yeah.
essentially, the easiest way to put it is if I have a patent that says you attach these two things with a screw, Dominic can't then make something that uses a nail and not be free from patent infringement. It's, if you're using substantially the same thing to substantially the same end, it's going to fall into it. And this seems like a decent, unless there was some indication that, Amazon didn't enable that Amazon didn't invent the below as opposed to alongside, or that it wasn't really within the scope of the patent. I think the doctrine of equivalence would swallow up that argument that I just made.
Yeah. And the US is a first to invent jurisdiction, so it's possible that there might be another company out there that is going to say, hey, we have records showing that we invented this first. And provided they timely filed, but at this point, since it's been issued, I guess they would have to file an interference motion after it's been filed. Is that what it is called? I'm forgetting.
Yeah, so they'd have to file their own patent that clearly contradicts or clearly is claiming the same thing that the Kindle does, and then at
Well,
one once that starts being prosecuted, one of the two parties would have to file an interference to see which party. And an interference is basically like a mini trial that happens in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, complete with discovery dates and hearings and depositions, and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office would eventually decide who was the first to invent that item.
couldn't you just file a declaratory, an action-seeking declaratory judgment, so that to clarify that you're not infringing on the patent, and within the course of that litigation, seek to invalidate the patent?
You could, but that wouldn't then establish the rights of the first inventor. So,
Oh, okay. Well, those are actually two separate issues, I suppose, at least in the legal sense.
yeah, so while the Nook people may want to file this declaratory judgment suit, and I think before they did that, there'd have to be some sort of legal threat from Amazon that they're actually going to be sued, but they could file this suit and say we want to get it declared that the Amazon patent doesn't apply to the Nook, or if you rule against us, does apply to the Nook. And that wouldn't establish if Nook was also saying that we invented the dual screen reader first, that they actually did invent that. Then you'd have to go through an interference procedure in the Patent and Trademark Office. The Patent and Trademark Office are the only people who can grant patent rights. Meanwhile, pretty much any court, any district court, can take them away.
It could also be the case that, maybe the Nook guys just decide that they don't want to go through all that expensive litigation after all, and they'd just rather pay a license fee on the basis of this patent if, if both parties seem to agree that the patent fits squarely within the Nook technology. and, you know, just avoid litigating at all.
Yeah, we should mention that the other ebook reader that's currently out there that allegedly violates the patent is the Alex, which is not a very well-known reader. I think they've partnered with Barnes & Noble, and they're trying to get some traction here, but it's a market that's quickly becoming saturated, and the Alex has not really taken off.
Incidentally, all the displays use the same technology, the e-ink. There's just one company, and they have a patent on it, so they're using it on all the devices. It's kind of cool in that sense.
Yeah, on a quick side note, do you know if the Pixel Qi display is also licensed from that same people, or is that a different technology? So, explain what this is, Pixel Qi, it's a display that can switch between full-color LCD and e-ink. So a power-saving, visible and bright sunlight mode, but slow to refresh, and a full-color LCD, not visible in bright sunlight, but with, you know, color.
I believe it's a separate company.
Okay.
Because people are billing it as an e-ink killer, and it would be unlikely for the e-ink company to release its own e-ink killer. Especially since they're pushing their new Pearl display, which is visible in the new Kindle DX, and probably will be coming to a Kindle this fall. Yeah, they're a startup. So they're a separate company. When I looked at the first claim, the main claim on this, which is claim 5 in the patent, the language that jumped out to me was, the second display includes graphic elements that correspond to portions of the first display, and it's responsive to user input to one of the graphical elements to perform at least one action on the content shown. In other words, you're going to be interacting with this second display in some way, and I think the Nook falls under that, but I'm not sure about the Alex. I haven't seen that much about that device.
Right, I haven't gotten my hands on the Alex either, but I do agree that, you know, the Nook definitely falls into that with its... I used it very shortly after it was introduced, and the user interface was wretchedly awful, but it did fall into that, where, you know, you'd have a little up-down, left-right keypad on the, you know, LCD portion of it, and when you hit that, you'd see changes on the actual display. Or, you know, you'd see a... scrollable display of books, which corresponded to books that were also being displayed on the Nook screen, on the e-ink screen, and if you clicked one of the books on the lower screen, it would correspond to one of the books on the actual screen and open it up.
From what I've read about the Alex, I haven't actually seen the device myself. I haven't seen one anywhere. It looks like it has the same sort of similar navigate your books down here, and then they'll appear up there, which I can see the point for, considering navigating on a Kindle is really, really painful. But I guess that would fall under the same patent. But at this point, we just need to wait and see what Amazon's going to do with this patent. It was just issued by the time this podcast goes live a week ago. So we'll have to see what they do, what they'll do. The most likely thing is they'll probably just try to license it and get some sort of royalties. If people want to take them to court, though, it should definitely prove an interesting case to watch. Although the vast majority of patent cases settle, so I doubt we'd actually get to see the full-blown jury and trial and all that, but it'd be really cool if we did. Any final thoughts on this?
No, other than that, no, never mind. I just don't have any other thoughts.
David?
I'm good.
All right, then take us away with our last story.
So our last story involves a lawsuit that was recently filed in the Northern District of Illinois. A company called Gatehouse Media, which publishes local newspapers, including the Rockford Registered Star in Rockford, Illinois, go Rockford Files, was suing a company called That's Great News, LLC. So Gatehouse Media publishes all of their content under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Which is similar to the license that this is published on. I think we do attribution, non-commercial, but with derivatives. That sound right?
Yes.
Share alike.
Oh, right. And share alike.
Right. We are by NCSA.
Yes. So they publish all of their content under that. The defendant in this case, that's Great News, sells reprints of articles on fancy plaques to people who are in those articles.
The name of the defendant is actually That's Great News, by the way.
Yes. Probably not obituaries, but other things like fireman rescues cat from building. The fireman could go to That's Great News LLC and say, could you republish this article for me on a plaque so that I can put it on my wall? And Gatehouse Media was not pleased with this because their license specifically prohibits that, and this is copyright infringement otherwise, because people are republishing their copyrighted work without complying with the license, which is specifically for non-commercial uses only. I think this is interesting because this is, I think, only the second suit that somebody's been tracking and that anyone has found where people are specifically saying that violation of the license terms for Creative Commons creates copyright infringement. Although in this case, the plaintiff is suing for both copyright infringement and breach of contract. My guess is that's just a CYA, cover your ass type of thing, where they're saying, listen, the way Creative Commons is written, it would be copyright infringement to breach any of the covenants in this license. However, we're suing under both just in case the court, goes bonkers and decides that this is breach of contract. So I should mention, there was one other suit. It's going to be in the show notes. That suit settled. My guess is this suit is also going to settle because this isn't a huge... This shouldn't be a lot of money at risk. This shouldn't be a huge issue. But it's interesting to see that people are actually asserting their rights under Creative Commons. Any initial thoughts, Dominic or David?
Well, Evan Brown, who is an attorney based out of Chicago, I believe, and Ben and I have appeared on This Week in Law with Evan... once or twice. Evan is the person who sort of tipped us off to the story on his blog, Internet Cases, and he was really perplexed, I think, by the claim of breach of contract, and he was sort of pondering or musing, if you will, openly without any real answers about why they would pursue a breach of contract claim instead of a copyright claim, although I believe in the actual complaint they alleged both. And like you mentioned, Ben, it's sort of a little bit of CYA. I always like to think of it as you always want to cover all your bases when you're litigating a case. If you file a complaint, you want to allege every claim that you possibly can, just in case something goes wrong procedurally or there are some facts that you weren't aware of, that if one of those claims, like say the copyright claim for whatever reason, gets thrown out on a motion to dismiss, then you can still continue to litigate the case on the basis of a breach of contract claim. So when you're dealing with licenses, you're often talking about, licenses are contracts, but you're also talking about the underlying copyrights, meaning the actual rights themselves that are associated with the work. And I think Evan was wondering about the covenant versus condition differences in the Creative Commons licenses, and that is the actual wording. A covenant is sort of, if I could put it in layman's terms, it's like an affirmative promise not to do something or to do something. You're basically assuring that something will or will not happen, or you'll take some sort of action or not take some sort of action. A condition, on the other hand, is more like an if-then statement. So if X happens, then you do this. And for whatever reason, Evan seemed to think that the wording of the Creative Commons license at issue was written so that it forms conditions, not covenants, I think, if I read his blog post correct. Is that right, Ben?
Yes, I think so.
I have given this particular Creative Commons license a quick read, and it actually looked a little bit more like they were covenants and not conditions. So... he didn't, in his blog post, he didn't really provide any details as to why he thought they were being written like that. But, aside from that, I didn't really find that there was anything too curious about this case. So if you think about the way that a contract works and the way that a license works, you've got an instrument that is now substituting between what the two parties are agreeing on in terms of what you get when you're accessing the content itself. With a Creative Commons license and with content that you're just sort of throwing out there, you're sort of forcing people who are viewing the content and consuming that content to agree to those terms. and that those terms are basically governing the relationship between you two. And so you and you being the website owner or the content creator and the user or the reader. And so there might be some interesting questions in there about the validity of the Creative Commons license or whether or not, you know, these are in fact conditions or whether there are actual covenants that are written within the license. But the way that I'm reading it, you know, it seems pretty straightforward that these look more a little bit more like covenants to me. And you're sort of saying like, okay, we own all the copyrights, all the exclusive rights to this work. You're allowed to do the following things. And they basically lay out that you're not allowed to create derivative works, and you're not allowed to sell those derivative works either. And so when you're taking that content and reprinting it or putting it onto a plaque or something, it seems to stand in direct violation of that exclusive right, and the license itself explicitly says that that's not okay.
I mean, other than that, this is an interesting thing to keep our pulse on, as all of these developing lawsuits are with the different open source and Creative Commons style licenses. I think the biggest takeaway is that just because something's on the internet doesn't mean that, one, you can take it for free, and two, just because something's Creative Commons licensed doesn't mean that you can do whatever you want with it. You know, it's worth taking a second glance to see whether or not you can legally use this content, or, you know, whatever content our listeners may be thinking of using before you just jump and do it, because this is probably going to end up costing this company a bit of money, even if they settle. You know, they're going to have to hire a lawyer and go through all that.
Let me jump in real quick here. I did see a link that was posted in that section where he talked about conditions versus covenants, and apparently Evan is relying on some of the issues that deal with open source licensing, which I really view as different than Creative Commons licenses, because in a lot of the open source licenses, you're requiring people who are allowed, by the way, under the license itself to create derivative works, but they must make the derivative code that they create, if you're talking about software code, they must make that also open, or at least the portions that utilize the code which they're borrowing under the open source license, they must make that portion open. And that does function much more like a covenant, perhaps, but, you know, and the real question is whether you litigate it as a claim of infringement or a contract claim. You know, because that's not actually a right, though, that's embodied within the Copyright Act, that's usually something, at least that I would think about, that you would want to pursue as a breach of contract claim, not as a copyright infringement claim. I don't know if that helps clear it up a little bit.
And obviously there are going to be advantages and disadvantages to both of those. As we've discussed earlier, a big advantage to copyright is that you can get statutory damages, which can be grossly excessive compared to what your actual damages are. Meanwhile, remedies like that, especially those huge monetary remedies, are not available, usually for contract cases. Any last thoughts before we wrap this up, Dominic?
All set. It'll be interesting to see how it turns out. This isn't the first time that this company sued on Creative Commons issues.
Right. And David, any last thoughts?
I do think that this looks pretty cut and dry to me, but we'll see if some issues pop up that we haven't considered here.
Okay. In that case, I would like to thank you all for listening and tuning into Technically Legal. As always, you can find us on our website, www.technicallylegal.org. Email us questions, suggestions, story ideas, and at podcast@technicallylegal.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, @TechLegal is our handle. So signing off, I'm Ben Snickoff.
I'm Dominic Gravier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for joining us.